It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Legislative Black Caucus has elected a new slate of office holders as lawmakers prepare to head back to the state capitol next month for the new session.
State Senator Dora Drake of Milwaukee will continue to serve as chair of the 10-member caucus. Drake moved to the upper chamber of the capitol after winning a special election for a state senate seat that covers a large part of northern Milwaukee County.
And she joins us now to discuss the priorities of the Legislative Black Caucus and the work of advocating for Black Wisconsinites. Senator Dora Drake, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be back with you guys today.
Well, starting with the Legislative Black Caucus, why did you decide to seek another term as chair?
Well, you know, I believe that the work that we were doing for the last couple of years was important to carry on. You know, a lot of the things that we were championing and pushing for were things around economic opportunity, justice, and of course, advocacy for what the best interests of Black Wisconsinites, and frankly, also the African diaspora. And so seeking another term was honestly a position of wanting to serve not only the people that I work with, but also the whole state. And so I'm excited that I have the support of my colleagues, and I'm excited for the work that we'll be doing moving into next session.
So there are 10 lawmakers in the caucus from the Assembly and Senate. What is your view on Black political representation in the legislature and the impact on the Black community in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it's important. Because our voices are sometimes diminished in terms of the issues that we push for. You know, what I'm excited about the members in our caucus is that we represent different areas of the whole state now. We now have representation from the Green Bay area, which we've never had before. And so it is a reflection of the growing population of Black Wisconsinites, not just here in Wisconsin, but frankly, our political influence. And so it's important to note that our representation for the issues that matter to our community matter. And so because we need to be at the table to not only share what those voices are, but also to address the issues that pertain to us and the communities that we represent. So whether it's addressing poverty and the social determinants of health, those are the things that guide our agenda, you know, for pushing what's best for the next session.
I wonder, is that greater representation that you see from around the state, is that a result of more competitive districts?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that. You know, now granted, you and I have had conversations that obviously I'm excited that we have hair maps and that in Wisconsin, we have had the opportunity to now really promote democracy and break the gerrymander that Wisconsin Republicans have pushed, you know, for over a decade now. So when it comes to competitive seats versus, you know, minority majority districts, it's important to note that nationwide, there is a push to diminish the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to note that Wisconsin, even though we gain seats, we have to maintain the reality that competitive seats doesn't necessarily mean, you know, majority and minority seats. And if anything, we need to ensure that those statutes that guide our determinants of how to create those seats are still in the front line of what it means to push for democracy and ensure that we still have fair maps in Wisconsin and push for that even more in the near future.
Senator Drake, let's look at the composition now of the Senate. In the November election, Democrats broke the Republican-held supermajority in your chamber. So now you see 18 Republicans, 15 Democrats. More balance on both sides of the aisle. Will that affect what the Legislative Black Caucus will prioritize?
It shouldn't affect it because our issues have always been the same, regardless of who was in the majority or not. Is there opportunity to push for the issues that we care for? Absolutely. And to the point that I shared earlier, you know, economics, whether it is, you know, addressing the funds that might come or not come because of the incoming, the incoming president that's coming in, or even education equity. Those are the things that we are caring about, that we care about. And there's a huge push for special reimbursement education. And so, again, it doesn't change our stances on the issues that we care about, but there's definitely opportunity in the state legislature to push those issues forward.
I was going to say, are there particular issues that you think will gain traction this session or that you will want to push harder on? You mentioned education there.
Yes. So, you know, I know for me as the Legislative Black Caucus chairwoman and also being in leadership, I've always shared with everybody that the door is always open, you know, to address issues. And so I believe the top issue that we'll be hearing is what does it mean to support Wisconsinites? You know, the cost of living has been going down, but that doesn't mean that the reality of everyday people are struggling to either put food on the table, you know, wanting to make sure that their children get to school safely and also have the resources available to have the best outcomes for their families. And so my biggest push, things to look at would be things to address issues of poverty, you know, because according to a report from Wallet Hub, they found that Wisconsin has the third largest racial wealth gap in this country in 2024. And we are two states behind. Washington, D.C. and North Dakota fell underneath us. So there's a lot of work to be done. And so I'm sure that's going to be a top issue at hand. And with education, you know, with the surplus that we have, I am excited for the opportunities we have, but I hope that there is an additional funding for not just our K-12 education, but from what I and other colleagues have been hearing, the need to push for reimbursement for special education as well.
We're talking with Democratic State Senator Dora Drake of Milwaukee, looking at the next year, the next session in politics. Drake will chair the Wisconsin Legislative Black Caucus, continue chairing it, and we're exploring the priorities of the caucus. I want to turn to you and the campaign, mental health resources and transparency in education, other issues you brought up in your campaign. Mm-hmm. In the wake of the shooting this week at the Madison Private Christian School, what is your response to the shooting?
You know, unfortunate is an understatement. You know, when the news came out, initially I thought it was actually a school in my district because I heard Madison and I have a high school, a James Madison, that I represent. And so my first initial thought, honestly, was to drop everything and see what was going on. But after learning the details of, you know, what's to come, and obviously there's still pieces of the story that are coming out, it is heartbreaking that our state, and when I say state, I have to reiterate that Wisconsin Republicans have failed to do anything around addressing gun violence. You know, many of my colleagues have pushed and I've supported efforts on either background checks for guns or, you know, making sure that there's some sort of process to determine if someone is capable of even having a firearm, and then giving means and measures to either that family or a trusted member of the community to say, hey, you know, we need to find a different method where we can remove this so you don't harm yourself or others. So it's disheartening. And frankly, it's time to do something about it.
Do you expect there to be more conversations among lawmakers across the aisle on how to prevent school shootings?
It should. And frankly, it's overdue. I don't understand how we let so much life get lost. And these are our babies and our kids at this point. So it needs to be a top priority for next session. And what I want to also mention, too, is that, yes, with the shooting, it is devastating. I want to make sure that we actually give the family and the victims the space and grace to grieve, is because there's a difference from addressing gun violence. But there's another completely different tier around mental health. And was mental health maybe a piece of it? Yes. But mental health is so much larger than that. You know, mental health can be caused either through a traumatic incident, not just by gun violence, but you could have lost your job and you've been searching for months and you feel like there's no point. It could be someone that's getting out of custody for the first time, that they've done their due diligence, they've served their time, and they can't find housing. Those are the things that can impact someone's mental health. And if it's taking 6 months just to find someone to talk to, or even getting over the barrier of saying it is okay not to be okay, that's what we need to address. And so I am excited that, And I'm actually proud of some legislators that have started looking at our Chapter 51 laws about people that are really experiencing a mental health episode where they might have to be taken, you know, having to be taken in to get resources. And there are, you know, systems that we have set up that do not make it easy for anyone to get those resources. So whether that is finding ways where law enforcement isn't inadvertently trying to re-traumatize that individual that's going through a mental health episode, or even having more community-based centers where someone can check in and get the resources they need before having to be institutionalized. Those are the things that we need to be addressing around mental health, not just when there's a mass shooting. And again, it's unfortunate, mm-hmm. and unfortunate is an understatement, but we need to be looking at the larger picture here too.
And just a bit here on larger picture, in our last minute together, you have facing a roughly $4 billion budget surplus to work with in this new session. Where mm-hmm. should the money go? What would be your top line priority?
Well, you know, there's so many things. I think it needs to be focused on what will look like to make lives better for Wisconsinites. So that is obviously making, whether it's the economic piece of supporting families to education, you know, that's where I love to see things. There's so much more that could be pushed, but we need to invest in our kids. Our kids are our future. And if they don't get the education they need, we are, you know, going to be in a pretty tight spot. And so those are some of the things I hope to see in the upcoming session.
Very quickly, would you push for any tax relief, tax cuts?
I'm open for whatever ideas come to the table. You know, that's obviously an issue that's been coming up frequently. And so I'm always open to looking at what that looks like. And as Senate Democrats being on leadership, I know that confidently the table's always open to see what ways we can come together and work on something.
Senator Drake, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me so much. You guys have a great weekend and happy holidays to everyone.
You too. Dora Drake is a Democratic state senator for a district covering much of northern Milwaukee County. We talked about her priorities in the new legislative session as she chairs the 10-member Wisconsin Legislative Black Caucus.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, proposed DNR rules aim to boost bat safety in the state with some new regulations for wind energy generators.
That will allow the turbines to have fewer chances to have bats running into the turbines.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about proposed changes for wind farms in Wisconsin that could help protect bats.
First, we're listening back to a WPR reporter's journey into a cave that's been made into a safe zone for bats. Here's Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum.
Bats are an important part of Wisconsin's wildlife. But over the last decade, a fungal disease called white nose syndrome has devastated bat populations in the state and across the country. In rural Crawford County, a cave that once was a tourist attraction is now protected by the Mississippi Valley Conservancy. It's a safe haven for the bats to hibernate and help scientists develop ways to stop the disease. Most of these bats have settled in for the winter, but before they returned, WPR's Hope Kerwin traveled underground to learn more about this unique cave.
So the entrance to the cave is inside this little building. Welcome to Kickapoo Caverns. I'm Sarah Bratnober. I'm Communications Director at Mississippi Valley Conservancy. This doorway is really the only way in for people, but if you look up there, you see a little slot along the edge of the ceiling there. That's where the bats come in. Some bats fly south in the winter to relax and be snowbirds, but there are four species of bat. They tend to hibernate here in the Northland. And so they look for places to hibernate where they're not going to freeze to death over the winter. There are a few low spots, so we're going to just take a little duck down here. We are in a completely different space now. We're underground. Oh, this must be 15 feet tall, the ceilings here. All around us, we're seeing kind of a flowing forms of limestone that are being dissolved. It's very damp in here because water is a part of what's going on that created this cave and continues to shape it. Do you see those cages under the stairway? We're making research accessible for the DNR and their partners to actually study possible solutions to the white nose syndrome. It's a fungus that's in this cave, and it makes their skin itch. It makes them wake up. And in the middle of winter, then they start flying around looking for something to eat, and they just don't have the calories stored for them to be able to fly around. There is nothing to eat down here in the winter, and most of them have starved as a result of being awoken. One of the things we do is just help people to be aware of bats and what bats need and why bats are good and what people can do for bats. But, you know, a lot remains to be seen about how the bats will do with this fungus in the environment. Will they develop a resistance to it? Is that why some of the bat populations in Wisconsin are coming back in the last year? We don't know yet. Okay, here we go. We're just about at the end of the cave now. And if we go down to the very end here and look over the edge, you will see that is a pool of water right there. A lot of people have never seen anything like this before. And kids who get the chance to come down here are really wowed by it. You know, what a great way to introduce them to some of these ideas about conservation.
WPR's Hope Kerwin took us on a tour of the Kickapoo Caverns. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Over the last two decades, white nose syndrome has decimated multiple bat species here in Wisconsin and across the U.S.
Because of that, accidental bat deaths from wind turbines are having a bigger impact than they usually would.
The state DNR is proposing a rule that would require wind operations in the state to make some changes to protect bats. That rule is currently open for public comment.
Stacy Rowe is an Endangered Resources Energy and Transportation Specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Stacy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before we dig into the proposed rule changes, I want to look at the basic concern here, the worry that wind turbines can have an impact on our bats, our bat populations in Wisconsin. What do we know about the impact of bat turbine impacts?
Yeah, so bats, unfortunately, are drawn to wind turbines for unknown reasons, whether they think that they're trees or are drawn in for other purposes. But because of that, wind turbines throughout the United States have had a negative impact on bats, killing upwards of 1 million of them each year.
So what are the proposed changes in Wisconsin rules that could help deal with that problem?
So we are looking at requiring turbines both currently on the ground as well as proposed facilities to implement higher cut-in speeds for their turbines, which essentially means that will be the turbines will not start rotating until they're at a certain wind speed, whether that's the 3.5, 5, or 6.9 being proposed. That will allow the turbines to, in certain areas, to have a fewer chances to have bats running into the turbines or being drawn to the wind facilities when those turbines are rotating.
Now, part of the change here, and this can sound a little bureaucratic, has to do with the incidental take rules. And I'm hoping you can explain that. I'm on the mailing list for incidental take notifications for the DNR. I don't really know what that means or what that how those fit into rules. What is that?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, our state endangered species law prohibits impacts or take or essentially killing of state endangered and threatened animals all throughout Wisconsin. We currently have what's called a broad incidental take permit out there for cave bat species, which allows some taking or killing of bats throughout the state, which up until this point did not have any requirements of the wind proponents because they we just did not know enough research or have enough information to know how best to protect bats as a result of wind turbine impacts. And now that we are seeing research that's coming out documenting that, yes, curtailment and higher cut-in speeds works, this is why we're implementing this broad incidental take permit, which will allow for some taking of bats to occur if the turbines are able to implement these curtailment restrictions.
Now, I understand some of the rule changes would be date-specific and maybe time-specific at night in particular and during the height of bats flying around when they're not hibernating, I guess. How would this work timing-wise?
So timing-wise, we'd only be looking at when the bats are active, which is typically April through October. We also are focusing on evening or nighttime hours, so essentially from sunset to sunrise when bats are most active.
And is this location-based as well?
Yes, so it is also location-based. We are looking at essentially two areas. So we are focusing on what we are calling bat priority areas, meaning that if you are within a certain distance of a known bat hibernaculum or maternity roost, there will be higher curtailment or cut-in speeds required, which is the speeds will be so high that we are essentially avoiding impacts to bats. Elsewhere throughout the state, there will be requirements, but because you're not as close to a known bat hibernaculum or maternity roost, then those cut-in speeds will be lower, recognizing that there will be some take, but it will be minimized to the extent that we can minimize it.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. If the blades of the turbine are turning faster, that's safer for bats?
So what it means by having a higher cut-in speed is that the blades will not start spinning until the wind speeds are at a certain higher wind speed. So the lower the wind speed, then the blades will not be moving until they reach that higher wind speed.
Gotcha. Now, I would imagine there's concern from people operating wind farms that this will have an economic impact. If they're turning the turbines less, well, then they're going to produce less energy. What do you know about concerns and how these kind of things have impacted production elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, there certainly are that concerns. And we did meet with various wind stakeholders prior to putting this out for public notice to try and understand those concerns ahead of time and really get an idea as to what at that time, you know, what we think the impacts would be. We do know that there are certain similar requirements in other states, including Minnesota, Illinois, as well as other states out east. There also are federal recommendations for those federally listed bats to have these very similar curtailment and cut-in speeds as well.
Now, this is a rule change process. You're in a public comment period right now. when you have a public comment period, who is invited to comment? What kind of things are you hoping to hear from residents, stakeholders, whoever might join in?
Yeah, we are asking for everyone from the public, general public, to comment on this, from biologists, from those who have concerns about bats, and especially our wind stakeholders. We want to know how this is going to work for them, if we can make things better, while at the same time protecting our bat species. You know, we at the Wisconsin DNR are certainly encouraging renewable energy throughout the state, but at the same time, we want to do what we can to protect our bat species and are trying to meet in the middle with this broad and small take permit to ensure that we're meeting both needs.
So what's the timeline like on a process like this? Is it possible that these new rules, maybe modified some, would be in effect in time for the bat season 2025?
That's the goal. So right now, the public comment period did get extended. It is now ending January 15th, 2025. After that point, we will be reviewing all the comments that are received and are hopeful that we can get enough in there to, you know, to possibly make some changes. Again, we want to be making sure that any changes that are made are going to be for the benefit of the bats. And if we can help out the wind industry as well, that's the goal. But yes, the ultimate goal is to get these finalized in time for the bat active season to start in April.
We're talking about proposed DNR rule changes aimed at decreasing bat deaths caused by impact with wind turbines. Our guest is Stacy Rowe, Endangered Resources, Energy and Transportation Specialist for the DNR. Stacy, we're talking about bats in particular because wind power is not the only concern, right? We've had this long-running problem with white nose syndrome being part of the threat to bats in the state. Can you talk about the state of our bat populations?
Yeah, so white nose syndrome reached Wisconsin in 2014. So we've been living with it, dealing with it for over 10 years now. And unfortunately, our four cave bat species are very negatively impacted by white nose syndrome, and their populations have significantly declined, even to the point of one of them being a federally threatened species and another species also being federally proposed to be listed. So they've really negatively impacted our bats. And we're just starting to potentially see those populations maybe start to recover, maybe not, but it's going to take a very, very long time to see bat populations get to where they used to be 10 years ago.
Which species is most particularly worrisome right now?
So the we have four cave bats that are state listed in Wisconsin. They are the northern long-eared bats, the tri-colored bat, as well as the little and big brown bats.
And which one did you say was federally threatened right now?
The northern long-eared bat is the species that is federally threatened, and the tri-colored bat is the one that is being proposed for federal listing.
And what kind of efforts, apart again from this wind turbine issue, what kind of efforts have there been in the state to help, figure out what the problem is, what's leading to the spread of white nose syndrome, and to help bats deal with it?
Yeah, our DNR bat team has been doing quite a bit of assisting with other types of research, including looking at the fungus itself. How can we vaccinate our bats for that fungus, and just other ways that we can really prevent the spread of that fungus from spreading to other hibernacula and prevent those from impacting our bats?
Can you talk a little bit about the benefits that bats bring to humans and to ecosystems?
Bats are really prolific insect eaters, and so they do quite a number on eating not only just mosquitoes. We all don't like mosquitoes here, but other insects as well. And just really by being a part of that ecosystem, by allowing, you know, having feeding on the insects and also having some predators feed on bats, they're right in the middle of our ecosystem, where they're going to be providing a lot of benefit, both from, again, eating on insects as well as getting preyed on from other predators.
Bringing things back to wind power now, supposing this rule is passed, I understand there's going to be some data collection going on for years to see what kind of impact this has. Can you talk about that? What specifically would you be looking at?
Yeah, so the other piece of the broad install take permit is to implement monitoring for those turbines not within a bat priority area. And the monitoring is going to be looking at exactly what kind of bats are being impacted from the curtailment regimen that we're going to have these turbines be following. If the turbines are still seeing a high mortality in bats, we may want to implement other measures. And if we're not seeing high mortality, well, then we may want to, you know, look at other things as well. But we're really just trying to document within Wisconsin how these measures are going to be helping or not help our bat populations.
And we mentioned that public comment period earlier. If people want to weigh in, what do they do to share their thoughts?
The public is more than welcome to email me. My email address is stacy.rowe@wi.gov. They can mail me comments at my Janesville DNR address, which is listed on the public notice. They can also call in comments as well, although it is a little bit easier to mail or email them in.
And we'll share that information online as well. Stacy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Stacy Rowe is an Endangered Resources, Energy, and Transportation Specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She talked to us today about the agency's proposed rule changes aimed at decreasing bat deaths caused by wind turbines. Again, the agency is taking public comments now through mid-January on those proposed changes.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a municipal airport in central Wisconsin is able to make new improvements and sees the economic development potential for the community.
We really want there to be success stories 10, 20 years from now where a company located in Portage because it had a safe and sustainable airport.
That's up next from WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a trip to a winter wonderland.
Every night between Thanksgiving and Christmas, about 300 homes in a West Dallas neighborhood light up their houses and their yards with their best holiday decor. Candy Cane Lane has been a staple since 1985, serving as a spectacular tradition for many families and friends. WPR's Mallory Chang takes us on a tour of the festive streets.
Candy Cane Lane has been one of the places that a lot of my friends from the Milwaukee area said I should visit, but I have to admit, I hadn't gotten a chance to yet. Until tonight.
First impressions. Walking through Candy Cane Lane. A lot of candy canes. Okay, there's a lot of lights on this one. This one has a giant abominable snowman. Not a lot of inflatables on this one.
Okay, but enough excitement. I was running late to meet Ken Perkle.
I'm not an inflatable guy.
Perkle has been living in the neighborhood for more than two decades, and he's been decorating the whole time, but he officially joined the Candy Cane Lane Committee in 2006.
I moved in, and I didn't know that Candy Cane Lane was quite like this. I thought, you know, this is a great thing, and it's a lot of fun, and I started decorating really, you know, a lot.
He refers to his style as traditionalist. Perkle doesn't have many LED lights or inflatables.
I got a lot of hodgepodge of a lot of different things. I got my big maple tree all lit up, and then I pick up things along the way.
In front of his house, he has a mannequin dressed up as Santa Claus leaning up against a fireplace mantle with an adult beverage, a sign that says Reindeer Crossing, along with an abundance of decor hanging from the tree.
I'm going to just say that I'm a fan of the penguins and the hot air balloons.
Yes, Yeah, there was a lady and her kids came through last night, and she goes, oh, yeah, the penguins from Madagascar, you know? And I go, yeah, they're up in the tree up there, you know?
I'm assuming your house is your favorite house.
There's a house on 94th Street that's very elaborate, very cool. You know, he's got all these lights on and stuff.
So we walked over.
Oh, that's the one?
Yeah, it's the one.
That's why I was a little late. I was staring at this one. There's so much to look at.
I know, and he does this all by himself.
Speaking of appearances, Perkle happens to look a lot like a certain famous jolly white bearded man.
Hi, Santa!
Hey, guys, how are you doing tonight, huh?
Does that happen a lot?
It happens all the time. All year long.
A huge part of Candy Cane Lane is their annual partnership with Midwest Athletes Against Childhood Cancer, also known as the MAC Fund. According to Perkle, they've been collecting donations since around 1987 to support a neighborhood kid who was diagnosed with cancer.
Jeremy Klein was diagnosed at 5 years old with cancer. And they started decorating, and people started driving through to look at their decorations. And some of the people said, you know what, we should go out there and put a bucket out there and get some money for the family. And they collected, I think, like $1,500 or $1,600 the first year. They thought, this is really good. So they contacted the MAC Fund, and they started Candy Cane Lane.
Since Candy Cane Lane started collecting donations, they've raised more than $3.5 million to the MAC Fund. And Jeremy Klein?
He's probably 45 years old now, you know, and he survived. He's a survivor.
Perkle plans to keep decorating his house and standing out in the street with the other volunteers as long as he can.
It's not only a tradition for us to decorate, it's a tradition for the people coming through. I'm getting to be close to 80 years old, and my body's wearing down, so I don't know how long I would be standing out here, but I'll probably be out here in a wheelchair and get somebody to decorate.
But before we left, WPR photojournalist Angela Major and I needed to do one final walk through Candy Cane Lane.
There's a NASCAR one on the corner right here. My brain is so happy to be here. There's so many things to look at.
Really cool. Oh, look at that.
That's so funny.
That was WPR Midday host and podcast producer Mallory Chang. Candy Cane Lane is open until Christmas Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
After nearly 3 years of uncertainty, a municipal airport in south-central Wisconsin is set to receive state and federal funds for safety improvements.
The Portage Municipal Airport is city-owned. Last year, the Portage Common Council tabled a resolution that looked into shutting down the airport.
But now the airport is in line to receive a type of grant funding from the Federal Aviation Administration called entitlement funding to make improvements.
We're learning about this municipal airport and its role in the community. Michael Boblick is the Portage City Administrator. Michael, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
And also here is Phil Livingston, who manages the Portage Municipal Airport, also Director of Public Works for the City of Portage. Phil, welcome.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Phil, let's start with you. Give us a sense of the air traffic. Who is flying in and out of this airport?
There's a plethora of individuals that fly in and out. We see some commercial aircrafts come and go, assisting with the local businesses, as well as some hobby aircraft for people who lease space from us on an annual basis, as well as just travelers that travel around from airport to airport within Wisconsin and make their stops at various municipal airports throughout the state.
What has volume been like? How busy is it?
I would say it's steady. We see a large influx clearly in the summer during aviation week. Outside of that, though, it's hard to pinpoint exactly daily operations, as we don't have a full-time person out there. But it has been fairly steady over the last few months.
So I wonder then who would be coordinating the takeoffs and landings and the details of air traffic at an airport like yours?
That is done by the pilots themselves. It's not like O'Hare or Madison by any means. There's no air traffic controller that's, you know, authorizing people for takeoff. It's done via the radios in each individual aircraft.
Michael, as the city administrator, how does the city feel about the airport's service to the Portage community?
The city council has approved just recently to accept the entitlement funds from the federal government to improve the Portage Airport. So I believe right now they've made a commitment to making it better and safer. I think there are many in the community that believe it can have a good effect on business retention and bringing in future industry, provided that the airport has the proper safety requirements and really meets the specifications to land certain types of aircrafts here.
And so backing up just a bit, Portage had submitted paperwork to the State Transportation Department's Bureau of Aeronautics, a plan several years ago. You sought then state and federal funds to help do some projects at the airport. What has come to fruition through this work?
Well, the city, to my knowledge, and before I even got here as city administrator, had never accepted federal entitlement funds for this airport, which is quite frankly sort of abnormal. If most airports, if they are qualified for it, do take it. And I think, you know, for a long time, there was sort of a debate about the utility of it. And there was an attempt to relocate it to a different part of town. And really, at this point, I think everybody at this point believes that the airport we have is the airport we're going to have, period. We're not building a new one. It's too costly. And that they finally accepted those entitlement funds, which means that every 2 years we'll be able to spend $300,000 of federal funds to improve this airport. And because it has never accepted those funding in the past, there is plenty of safety improvements and basic infrastructure projects to do with those funds. It will take us a long time to really get, I would say, up to par with where we should be with this type of airport.
And Phil, when you look at these federal funds coming your way to the airport, what are some safety improvements? What are some other projects that are really top of list here?
Yeah. So what we've done, part of accepting those entitlements is doing what we call a petition package through the BOA and through the FAA. And we've outlined a couple of projects that are short term dealing with safety that are really top of the list for us. Those include relocating some of our runway threshold lights, relocating our fuel facility, constructing some additional taxiways, relocating tie downs, and then doing some pavement maintenance on our main runway. Out of those projects, the first that we're looking to get accomplished would be that pavement maintenance. We're scheduled for the 2025 state project to do some crack sealing out there, and then we'll follow up with the relocation of our fuel facility.
So in terms of what Portage has to put up through funding, how much of the city's budget would go toward the airport, or what would the city be putting toward these projects?
So typically what you see with entitlement funds is a 95% match, both from the state and federal government. So the state kicks in 5%, the federal government kicks in 90%, and then the local match would be 5%.
Michael, when you look at what this particular airport means to the community, as you talked about the businesses that use it, the hobbyists who use it, what is the impact locally to have it operational, safe, and functioning airport?
You really have a responsibility to make it as safe as possible. And that's the whole point of this entitlement funds, bringing up to common standard so air pilots can land here knowing, you know, that it is meeting federal guidelines of thresholds, fuel farm, tie down areas, and the additional taxiways. I think it's only going to increase traffic. The pilot community is relatively small. It isn't a secret that Portage was one of the very few that did not take entitlement funds. And that tells you something. It tells you that things are probably not up to snuff compared to other ones. Now that we have accepted these funding, I just see greater interest. It tells you something. It's a place that you can invest. It's a place you can build a hangar and know that its future is relatively secure because of the acceptance of those funds. Part of the reason why it's taken so long for the city of Portage to take those funds is for 20 years, there was discussion about building a new airport. And quite frankly, that plan was never really feasible, but it sort of sucked all the oxygen out of the room. Like, why should we take funds for this airport if we're going to move it?
We're learning about future plans for the Portage Municipal Airport. That's a public use airport serving South Central Wisconsin. That is Michael Boblick, the Portage City Administrator. Phil Livingston is here, airport manager. You know, Phil, I'm thinking about your location. And as you talk about location for this airport, I mean, the Middleton Municipal Airport is like due south about 30 some miles. Do you see Portage in competition with other airports like yourself?
Certainly, I think that there's some competition between airports, but these airports, though they're competing for people purchasing fuel and people, you know, taxiing and tying down, I think everybody wants everybody else to succeed.
What is your timeline for improvements and also in terms of feedback from the local community as well? Will they be able to weigh in?
Yeah. So timeline for improvements. We're already working with the Bureau of Aeronautics on some of our short-term projects, such as that crack filling of the airfield pavements, as well as relocating the fuel facility. We'll start seeing some of those improvements as early as summer of 2025, and then possibly into 2026. As far as the public weighing in, anytime we go in for a petition package to request more funding for various projects, we do what we have what we call a public hearing for that. And at those times, the public is more than welcome to come in and weigh in on the specific projects.
You know, in terms of a long-term vision for this airport, what do you see it doing, you know, 5 years from now? What might this airport be like?
Ultimately, we really want there to be success stories 10, 20 years from now where a company located in Portage because it had a safe and sustainable airport, especially for those business owners that have locations in multiple parts of the country.
And Phil, for you, you know, getting back to where we are in this time of year where a lot of people are traveling for the holidays by plane, what advice can you give to travelers if they perhaps are flying into a small municipal airport or leaving from a small municipal airport?
Yep, I would always check for NOTAMs for certain airports. That's a notice to air missions, which is a notice that informs aircraft pilots of any potential hazards at a specific airfield or along the flight route. Obviously, with some of the weather concerns that we have in Wisconsin, it's always good to check before you're making your journey somewhere to make sure that they have snow cleared from their runway, that they don't have icy conditions.
Well, Michael and Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Phil Livingston manages the Portage Municipal Airport. Michael Boblick is the Portage City Administrator. We've been learning about improvements slated for a municipal airport in South Central Wisconsin and the impact it has on the local community. The bowling business has seen a lot of changes over the years, with some concerns that fewer people are interested in the sport.
But some bowling alleys are going strong in the state. On Monday, we'll hear from the owners of two Wisconsin bowling alleys, and we want to hear from you.
Are you a bowler? Are you in a league? Do you go with your family from time to time? Or is it something you used to do but just stopped?
If you do bowl, tell us where you do it and what kind of other things they have on offer when it comes to food, drinks, other entertainment options. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Rob, I bet you're throwing those strikes.
It's been a while since I've been to Chile, but actually talking to these bowling alley operators.
You're inspired.
I'm overdue.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.